It is Monday, October the 16th. This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us today. Coming up, Al-Shabaab blamed for a deadly Somalia blast.
The scale of this attack and the brutality captures our imagination, and the international community once again pays attention to Shabaab. It wouldn't come as news to anyone living in Somalia or Kenya.
Also ahead, tense U.S.-Iranian relations, voters at the polls in Austria, plus the music of George Benson. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. The most powerful bomb blast ever witnessed in Somalia's capital, Mogadishu, has killed at least 270 people so far, around 300 others wounded. Those numbers expected to rise. Somalia's government has blamed the al-Qaeda-linked Al-Shabaab extremist group for the attack, yet Al-Shabaab has not claimed responsibility, which they often do just after carrying out such an assault. VOA's Victor Beatty asked Greg Barton, chairman of the Global Islamic Politics at Deakin University, for his thoughts on no group claiming responsibility so far.
Look, it seems possible that there's an element of tragic accident in the way the bomb targeted civilians. There's suggestions that the attack may have been targeting the foreign ministry. That was the intention, possibly. In any case, the truck bomb, which was certainly a very powerful device, happened to go off when a oil tanker was parked next door to it, and that magnified the effect of the explosion. And almost all, if not all, the victims, as far as we're aware, are just ordinary Somalian citizens. So this is an embarrassment for a group that would try and present itself as standing up against the forces of tyranny and somehow representing the ordinary Somali citizen. I mean, it's the most callous and awful kind of violence, and the scale of it just intensifies that. So there's probably some embarrassment, or at least that seems plausible, that Shabaab now finds itself unable to back away from its culpability, and yet probably embarrassed that this attack is going to undermine any sense of public support for their cause.
This is rivals, of course, the Al-Shabaab bombings that were claimed earlier at the Garissa University in Kenya in 2015, and of course the U.S. Embassy bombings in both Kenya and Tanzania in 1998. If Al-Shabaab is responsible, what are they hoping to prove?
Yeah, those are horrible benchmarks to go all the way back to 98 with the embassy bombing. If they were trying to target the foreign ministry, then, as with all of these attacks, they're trying to show that they're still potent, that they're a force to be reckoned with, that years and years of African Union joint military operations against them and the concerted efforts, the best that the Somali government and the Kenya governments can do to limit them, hasn't limited them. So it's that classic case, we see it with Islamic State as well, that we're not going anywhere. So the insurgency needs to launch attacks to show its potency. In this case, they may well have miscalculated because they've shown their potency, but they've also shown their murderous side in a way that probably doesn't work to their interests.
Mogadishu, of course, is tragically a frequent target of such attacks on a much smaller scale, of course. Does this explosion shatter hopes of recovery in that nation?
It just confirms what a long way ahead there is. Al-Shabaab was driven out of Mogadishu. Of course, it emerged out of the African Union, African Courts Union movements in 2006, 2007, but it was driven out of Mogadishu in 2012. So it's not had any military presence in the city for 5 years, and yet it's launched, sometimes separated by only a period of a week or two, a series of attacks into the Somalian capital. And although the scale of this attack and the brutality captures our imagination, and the international community once again pays attention to Shabaab, it wouldn't come as news to anyone living in Somalia or Kenya, and it just reinforces that until there's stable government in Somalia, and there hasn't really been for almost 30 years, the conditions that allow an insurgency to operate and infect itself across the border into Kenya will continue to remain, the group might be further constrained, but it's not going to be eliminated. At the moment, the southern half of the country, south of Mogadishu, outside of the major urban areas, is all if not under the control of Shabab, at least they're able to roam freely in those rural areas, including across the forested border into Kenya.
Hasn't there been a power struggle between al-Qaeda and Islamic State over the allegiance of al-Shabab, and does this perhaps show a change in tactics?
It's not clear what we should interpret from this particular attack yet, but it's true that there has been a struggle. I mean, Somalia, of course, in the absence of strong national government, is plagued, like many such countries, with clan-based rivalry, and that infects Shabab as well. Back in 2012, former leader of al-Shabab, Gaddane, drew it into the orbit of al-Qaeda and formed allegiances with al-Qaeda. Those allegiances seem as strong as ever, and perhaps growing stronger. But in the last 2 years, Islamic State tried to move in. Islamic State did get some support in the north of the country, in Puntland, but so far, it's failed to flip allegiance from al-Qaeda to Islamic State as far as global networks go. There are suggestions that al-Qaeda and Islamic Maghreb, based in Algeria, operating across Western Africa, is one of the conduits for al-Qaeda linkage. There's some suggestions of some, at least notional, linkages with Boko Haram in Nigeria. But if ever we should see a future leadership of al-Qaeda and Islamic State decide they're better off working together, it's places like Somalia and groups like Shabab that'll show the impact of that, and that's something I think we should be concerned about. So we'll forget about Shabab in a few days' time when news of this attack fades, but we need to bear in mind it's not going anywhere, and it may well be that this is the sort of challenges that we're going to be facing, not just in the region but around the world. We're seeing it already with the Taliban in Afghanistan. We'll certainly see it in Syria and Iraq with Islamic State going into the insurgent mode. We need to pay more attention to stabilizing these countries and restoring some modicum of good government.
That's Greg Barton. He is chairman of the Global Islamic Politics at Deakin University, and he was speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. This is VOA.
VOA Africa has built a successful, effective social media strategy through Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, and other digital platforms. We are responding to our audience on the African continent and in the global diaspora. We believe in the power of connection and interaction to bring you news that is comprehensive, accurate, and objective. We see the changes in technology as an opportunity to engage with our audiences about the issues that affect them. At VOA Africa, we don't just report the news, we help shape the conversation on the continent. VOA, your trusted source for news and information.
This is VOA's International Edition. U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson has conceded that Iran is, in his words, in technical compliance with the international agreement to curb its nuclear weapons development, but said President Trump wants Congress to adopt a more complete strategy to fix what Mr. Trump sees as flaws in the deal. Tillerson told CNN Tehran has what he called a demonstrated practice of walking right up to the limits of the 2015 deal, prompting President Trump or on to decertify Iran, as he did last week, for them being in compliance with this deal, and leaving it up to the Congress whether to impose economic sanctions that were in place before the U.S., the European Union, and France, Britain, Germany, Russia, and China reached that accord with Iran. VOA's Lori London talks with distinguished Professor Amin Saikal at the Center for Arab and Islamic Studies at Australian National University about the Iran nuclear deal.
The discussion started in the Sultanate of Oman between an Iranian and American delegations, and then subsequently was shifted to Geneva, and then there was direct face-to-face talks between the former Secretary of State John Kerry and Iranian Foreign Minister Javad Zarif.
So has Iran been in compliance of the deal?
Absolutely, and I think that has been verified by the International Atomic Energy Agency as well as by the European Union's and more specifically the three European signatories to the deal, that is France, Britain and to Germany.
We know that the Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, along with Defense Secretary James Mattis, both feel we should stay in the deal, but the president has said he is not going to recertify this. Why not just keep the deal and broaden the negotiations if there are things in it that he doesn't like?
Well, I think the Iranians have already said that the deal is not up for renegotiations. I mean, as far as they are concerned, that is a final multilateral agreement which has been signed between Iran and five permanent members of the United Nations Security Council plus Germany. And I think on that, Iran is very much backed by the European powers as well as Russia and China. But I think what President Trump really now wants to do is to see if the whole thing could be renegotiated. And, of course, he has basically lumped the Congress with that responsibility. And in what ways the Congress would be able to meet the demands of President Trump, I mean, that remains to be seen, because the Congress itself is very much divided over the whole issue. And, of course, there have been reports that the Congress may not really conform to the wishes of the president, in which case President Trump has said that he will reserve the right to cancel the agreement at any time.
How can Congress fix an international agreement?
Absolutely. And it is a multilateral agreement. It is not an agreement just between Iran and the United States. All the other world powers have been involved in it, and they are signatories to the whole thing. And, of course, the other powers have said that they are going to remain committed to the agreement. And I think that is most likely to cause a major rift, and I think it's already done to a considerable extent, between the United States and other world powers. And that does not really augur well for the United States' position to remain engaged in world powers, and more importantly, with its allies in Europe.
Right. I mean, you know, we already saw President Trump pull out of the Paris Climate Agreement. What is this going to do for our relations with other world leaders if they say, well, we can't count on the U.S. to stick to its agreements?
Well, I think it also sends a very bad message to the rest of the world. And that basically means that countries cannot really negotiate with the United States and to remain confident that the agreements that they signed would be honored by the United States. And also it sends a very powerful message to North Korea, and probably making its leadership to think twice before it sits down and negotiate anything with the United States, because first of all, conflicting messages coming out of Washington. Here is Secretary of State Tillerson saying that we will continue negotiating with we will continue to search for a diplomatic resolution with the Koreans. And on the other hand, the president has come out and said, look, I think this is basically a waste of time. So what sort of the message is that really conveys it to the North Koreans? I mean, it's very, very confusing. And obviously, the North Koreans will now do everything possible to guard themselves against the possibility of any American attack. I think the purpose of the North Koreans is basically regime survival, and therefore they see the development of their nuclear program as a guarantee, or basically guarding the survival of the regime.
So is his not recertifying different than actually pulling out of the deal altogether?
No, well, I think Secretary Tillerson and also the American ambassador at the UN, Haley, said that it doesn't mean that the United States is withdrawing from the agreement, but it wants to simply make it better. How it wants to really make it better? I mean, that is the main question, because that would require renegotiation of mm-hmm. the agreement. And the Iranians have said that that's not up for negotiations, renegotiations. And also the European powers have just simply backed the Iranian position. Although the French President Macron has said that perhaps some of the clauses could be renegotiated or could be reviewed. But then again, they will have to have the support of the Russians and the Chinese. And I doubt it very much that the Russians and the Chinese will come on board on that issue.
Amin Saikal at the Center for Arab and Islamic Studies at Australian National University, speaking with my colleague, Laurie London.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
Austria's 31-year-old foreign minister declared victory for his party Sunday in a national election that set him up to become Europe's youngest leader and puts the country on course for a rightward turn. Sebastian Kurz claimed the win as final results announced by the Interior Ministry showed his People's Party had a comfortable lead with almost all of the ballots counted. We asked Natalie Doyle, Monash University Deputy Director of the European and EU Center, why Austria is trending to the right politically.
In the case of Austria and Germany, the situation is slightly different because the left, in fact, was in open political government coalitions. They were not in the opposition. So, in a sense, the Austrian result is a rejection of those grand coalitions. But the fact is that in other countries, even though the parties, the socialist parties or the social democratic parties, depending on their terminology, were in fact very much part of a governing consensus, even if they were not in actual coalitions. And the electorates are basically rejecting the left because they feel that it's not that different from the right.
We also asked Dr. Doyle if immigration was the chief issue for voters.
Of course, immigration was the issue, and this was the consequence of the Syrian crisis and the decisions made by Angela Merkel and pretty much imposed on the rest of European Union members to, in fact, allow in all the refugees and to try and pressure countries to accept a quota of refugees right across Europe. Kurz is, in fact, been a big, big critic of Angela Merkel's, some would say, generous attitude towards refugees, her commitment to the humanitarian cause. He, in fact, said that it was really not acceptable because it was putting pressure on for example, welfare benefits. And certainly during the crisis, he sort of touched upon themes which were normally the preserves of the extreme right, Austrian identity, Islamization. The problem was particularly acute for Austria because it is, in fact, doing very well economically. So there was a kind of push within the immigrant population to try and make it to Austria through the Balkans. And Kurz claims, I don't know if that's true, that he played a big role in actually pressuring the European Union, and that means other countries in the European Union, such as just Hungary, to actually cut down the Balkan path, the path taken by immigrants towards Austria.
Austria, with a population of just under 9 million people, accepted 90,000 asylum seekers, most of them Muslim, during the 2015 migrant crisis. We were just speaking with Monash University Deputy Director of the European and EU Center, Natalie Doyle. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Scientists have determined that Saturn's largest moon, Titan, has a hydrological cycle similar to Earth. While Earth's cycle involves the circulation of water between land, sea, and atmosphere, on Titan, it's liquid methane that cycles this way. A new computer model-based study by researchers at the University of California, Los Angeles, suggests that powerful monsoon-like storms of methane pummel Titan's surface. Although the storms were found to take place less than once each Titan year, which is 29 and a half Earth years, the models show that the storms dump at least 30 centimeters of liquid methane a day, creating massive floods in terrain that is usually desert-like. The researchers say their findings could help provide scientists with new insights into the effect that climate change has not only on Earth, but on other planets as well. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us. In today's report from the music department, the sounds of a child prodigy turned international superstar. George Benson is an American musician, guitarist, and singer-songwriter. He began his professional career at the age of 21 as a jazz guitarist, considered by many to be one of the greatest in jazz history. Turn Your Love Around reached number one on the Soul Singles Chart and number five on the Billboard Hot 100 Singles Chart in early 1982, as well as the top 10 on the Jazz Chart. It was a big hit for Benson, who was born in 1943 in the U.S. city of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Another off-the-chart success for Benson came in 1976 with This Masquerade, written by singer-songwriter Leon Russell, who released it himself in 1972.
Are we really happy here with this lonely game we play? Looking for words to say. Searching but not finding understanding anywhere. Lost in a masquerade. Both afraid to say we're just too far away from being close together from the start. We tried to talk it over, but the words got in. Inside this lonely game we play.
George Benson's concerts were all sold out throughout much of his career, especially with hits like his version of On Broadway from the 1978 album Weekend in L.A. It hit number 7 on the Billboard Hot 100 and number 2 on the Soul Chart. It also led to a Grammy Award for Best R&B Vocal Performance for Benson.
They say the neon lights are bright on Broadway. They say there's always magic in the air. But when you're walking down that street and you ain't had enough to eat, the glitter rubs right off and you're nowhere.
Can you imagine trying to get something for a dime on Broadway now in New York? Let me tell you, super hit for George Benson, featured in many, many movies. The list is too long to even mention all of them. Hey, listen, thanks for joining us here on the Voice of America for International Edition. It's always good to have you with us. Latest world news is coming up shortly. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Greg Burns, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. We hope you have a super Monday. Now a bit more along Broadway from George Benson.
But they're drunk, I know they are, 'cause I can play this here guitar, and I won't quit till I'm a star on Broadway. I won't quit till I'm a star on Broadway.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
As of October 12th, Sudan will no longer be subject to 20-year-old U.S. economic and trade sanctions. The United States decided to lift certain sanctions with respect to Sudan and the government of Sudan in recognition of Sudan's sustained positive actions in five key areas. First, the government of Sudan has maintained a cessation of hostilities in Darfur and the states of South Kordofan and Blue Nile. Second, it has improved humanitarian access across Sudan. Third, it has refrained from destabilizing activity in South Sudan. Fourth, it deepened its counterterrorism cooperation with the United States. And fifth, it has improved regional security by taking steps to counter Joseph Kony and the Lord's Resistance Army. In an official statement, State Department spokesperson Heather Nauert noted that the government of Sudan's actions during the last 9 months show that it is serious about cooperating with the United States. However, much more progress is needed to achieve a lasting peace in Sudan and to cooperate with the United States on a range of priorities. These priorities include, among others, expanding humanitarian access, improving Sudan's human rights and religious freedom practices, and ensuring that the government ends its relationship with North Korea, to include ensuring full implementation and enforcement of UN Security Council resolutions on North Korea. According to a senior administration official, Sudan has pledged not to pursue or continue with any arms deals with the North Korean regime of Kim Jong-un. We will be closely monitoring the situation, and they understand that we have zero tolerance for continued arms deals with North Korea, the official noted. Despite the easing of sanctions, Sudan remains on the U.S. State Sponsors of Terrorism list. It also remains subject to U.S. and United Nations Security Council resolutions related to the conflict in Darfur, for which Sudan's president, Omar al-Bashir, faces international criminal prosecution on charges of war crimes, crimes against humanity, and genocide. The U.S. position remains unchanged on this issue. We continue to call for all those responsible for crimes in Darfur to be held accountable, said a State Department official. The United States, said spokesperson Nauert, is prepared to use additional tools to apply pressure if the government of Sudan regresses on progress in the five areas noted above, or takes negative actions on other areas of concern.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.